Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Rising inflation has brought a striking fall in real wages in many countries for the poorest workers, according to a new report from the UN Labour Agency, ILO. In a call for urgent measures to prevent deepening poverty, inequality and social unrest, the ILO said that global monthly wages fell 0.9% in the first half of this year. This is the first time this year that global wages have not increased, and the trend is clearest among some of the world's richest nations, where wages fell by 2.2%. That compares with emerging economies, where real wages grew by 0.8%, which is three times less than before COVID hit. ILO Director General Gilbert Hungbo urged governments to take steps to maintain the purchasing power of the lowest paid workers, or else see the post-COVID recovery endangered and further social unrest made more likely across the world. Staying with the world of work, the UN Migration Agency, IMO, on Wednesday unveiled an ethics toolkit for businesses that hire migrants to ensure that their rights are protected. Developed with Apple, the IOM toolkit strengthens due diligence checks when it comes to the recruitment of migrants, guided by best practice recommendations drawn up by the UN and other international organizations. The IOM toolkit initiative, which can be found online and downloaded for free, is in line with efforts to ensure fair and ethical recruitment as outlined in the Global Compact for Safe, Orderly and Regular Migration and the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs. In Chad, aid relief to the most vulnerable communities may soon be cut unless funding can be found urgently. The UN World Food Programme, WFP, and UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, have warned. WFP needs $161 million by the end of the year to avoid having to suspend its programme to crisis-affected families in Chad, along with more than 500,000 Sudanese and Central African refugees. The threat is particularly dangerous for refugee communities in Chad, which are already seeing acute malnutrition levels as high as 19%. In June, WFP had to offer half rations to refugees and other groups because of major funding shortages, and there are now fears that any further suspension of food assistance will lead to children being pulled out of school so they can work or being forced into marriage. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
That's your answer. That's your answer to everything. Tattoo it on your forehead. Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. Condolences. The bomb's lost. My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir. The bombs will always lose. Do you hear me, Lebowski? The bombs will always lose.
How was your meeting, Mr. Lebowski?
Okay. The old man told me to take any rug in the house.
Well, we got every rug in the house. Boy, yesterday was some day. I'm sorry we had a late start yesterday on weather on Wednesday. I didn't. But I got it up. And then I forgot to post it on Facebook or Twitter. So our numbers are down. But, you know, we don't do this for the money or the popularity. After all, we're in Kansas. Here's the latest headlines from this morning's Democracy Now.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House has passed legislation to block a nationwide rail strike by imposing a contract that's been rejected by unions representing the majority of freight rail workers. In addition, the House passed a separate bill by a much narrower margin to give 7 days paid sick leave to railroad workers, but it remains unclear if this provision will pass in the Senate. The vote came 2 days after President Biden pushed Congress to prevent the strike. On Wednesday, Senator Bernie Sanders slammed railroad carriers for refusing to provide workers any paid sick days while their profits soar.
Do we stand with workers in the rail industry and say, yes, you are right, working conditions are horrendous, we cannot continue a process by which you have zero paid sick leave? Do we stand with workers, or do we stand with an industry that is making huge profits, pays its CEOs exorbitant salaries, and treats its working workers with contempt?
In other news from Capitol Hill, House Democrats have unanimously elected Hakeem Jeffries of New York to lead the caucus, making him the first African American to head a political party in Congress. Jeffries, who is 52, will succeed Nancy Pelosi, who led House Democrats for 2 decades. Congressman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said the party could have benefited if the election to lead the party was contested, saying, quote, "This is the most significant generational change that we've seen in House Democrats in several decades. I personally believe that we would benefit from a debate on what that means," she said. While Jeffries is a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, he's been at odds with some progressives in the House. In 2016, he backed Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Last year, he told The Atlantic, quote, "There will never be a moment where I bend the knee to hard left democratic socialism," he said. On Wednesday, Democrats also elected Catherine Clark of Massachusetts to serve as whip and Pete Aguilar of California to serve as chair of the party caucus. Meanwhile, House Democrats have finally obtained Donald Trump's tax returns, ending a multi-year court battle. The Treasury Department released them to the House Ways and Means Committee Wednesday. In China, authorities have lifted some of the strictest lockdown restrictions in parts of Shanghai and Guangzhou as protests are continuing over the country's zero COVID policy. Video from Guangzhou, a major manufacturing hub, show police in hazmat uniforms confronting protesters. Russia is poised to expand its 2013 anti-LGBTQ law banning so-called gay propaganda. The law seeks to prohibit movies, advertisements, websites, and books featuring same-sex relationships or transgender characters in a positive light. Individuals found to be in violation of the law could be fined over $6,000. President Putin is expected to soon sign the law, which was approved by lawmakers. This is Ksenia Mikhailova of the Russian LGBTQ support group coming out.
This is a signal that all types of violence against LGBT people are allowed, better state. How it already happened in 2013, when was a wave of hate crimes against LGBT. Now it will be a tsunami.
Israeli authorities arrested the prominent Palestinian activist Issa Amro on Monday, days after he posted video showing an Israeli soldier throwing an Israeli activist to the ground, then punching them in the face in the city of Hebron in the occupied West Bank. Before he was released, Amro was reportedly beaten at the police station before he was interrogated. His home was also raided. Amro is the founder of Youth Against Settlements. On Wednesday, the Israeli activist Miko Peled tweeted, quote, "Issa's life is in danger. There must be guarantees to his personal safety," he said. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have killed another two Palestinians during a raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. According to Al Jazeera, Israel's now killed 8 Palestinians over the past 3 days in the West Bank. A U.S. citizen who lives in Massachusetts has been arrested on a trip to the United Arab Emirates and faces possible extradition to Egypt after he made a video calling on Egyptians to protest during the recent U.N. climate summit in Sharm el-Sheikh. The 46-year-old Sharif Osman is a former Egyptian army officer who's become a vocal critic of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Osman was arrested by two plainclothes officers in UAE November 6, 2 days after he arrived from the United States. The Biden administration's attempt to cancel hundreds of billions of dollars in student debt has been dealt another setback. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has rejected a request by the Biden administration to put on hold a ruling against the plan by a judge in Texas. The issue will likely now go to the Supreme Court. In a major victory for immigrant rights activists, the federal government has announced it's closing the Berks Detention Center in Pennsylvania. Groups including the Shut Down Berks Coalition have organized for years to close the facility, which was once used to imprison families as they sought asylum. Most recently, Berks was used as an immigrant women's prison. The Los Angeles Times has revealed ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, accidentally posted detailed personal information online about more than 6,000 asylum seekers in the United States. Immigrant rights advocates fear the unprecedented data release could jeopardize the lives of many immigrants who came to the U.S. fleeing torture and violence. A group of Yale students are suing the Ivy League university for discriminating against students with mental health challenges. The lawsuit alleges Yale pressures students to take voluntary leaves of absence if they're experiencing significant symptoms of mental health disabilities while suggesting the students might otherwise be suspended. Students who take leave, either voluntarily or involuntarily, often lose parts of their tuition and accommodation payments as well as access to student health insurance. The founder of the website Cryptome.org has written to the U.S. Justice Department with a strange request. He's asking to be indicted for violating the Espionage Act. Cryptome's founder, John Young, says he should be added as a co-defendant in the prosecution of WikiLeaks' Julian Assange because he published the same leaked government documents at the center of the U.S. case against Assange. While Julian Assange faces 175 years in U.S. prison if he is extradited and convicted, the U.S. government has never moved to prosecute John Young, who says he published the documents 2 days prior to WikiLeaks. Earlier this week, the New York Times and four international newspapers called on Biden to drop the charges against Assange, saying publishing is not a crime. President Biden announced new investments for indigenous communities, including $135 million to help 11 tribal communities severely impacted by climate change. Three of those communities are planning on relocating altogether. Biden spoke Wednesday at the White House Tribal Nations Summit.
There are tribal communities at risk of being washed away by superstorms, rising sea levels, and wildfires raging.
President Biden also vowed to protect Spirit Mountain, or Avi Quaame, in Nevada, a sacred site for the Fort Mojave tribe and others. Advocates have been pushing for years to designate the area as a national monument. The Justice Department is suing Jackson, Mississippi over its failure to provide its 150,000 majority black residents with safe drinking water. This is Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking on Wednesday.
Communities of color, indigenous communities, and low-income communities often bear the brunt of these harms. As we work to fulfill our responsibility to keep the American people safe, to protect civil rights, we will continue to prioritize cases like this one that will have the greatest impact on communities most burdened by environmental harm.
On Tuesday, the city of Jackson and the Mississippi Health Department agreed to federal oversight of its crumbling water system. In August, city officials issued boil water advisories across Jackson that lasted nearly 7 weeks. In Pennsylvania, the fracking company Coterra Energy has agreed to pay $16.2 million after pleading no contest for polluting the water in and around the community of Dimock. Coterra, which was previously known as Cabot Oil and Gas, will also pay water bill payments for the impacted residents for the next 75 years. The 2022 Right Livelihood Awards were given out Wednesday at a ceremony in Stockholm, Sweden. The award is widely known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. Winners included the Somali activist Ilwat Elman, who was recognized along with her mother for their work to bring peace in Somalia.
Somalia right now is facing the worst drought in the last 40 years. More than a million people are already internally displaced. If immediate action is not taken, we are on the brink of a famine.
Other winners of the 2022 Right Livelihood Awards included the Ukrainian group Center for Civil Liberties, led by Alexandra Mafichuk, the Venezuelan collective Siko Sisola, and the Ugandan Africa Institute for Energy Governance. Visit democracynow.org to watch the Right Livelihood Awards ceremony. And today marks World AIDS Day. UNAIDS is calling for a renewed push to combat the HIV virus after the world turned its focus to COVID-19 and other global crises over recent years. 1.5 million new HIV infections were recorded in 2021, 1 million more than the global target of 500,000, with an estimated death toll of 650,000. UNAIDS also reports dangerous inequalities persist with girls and young women, especially at risk. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And now, Law and Disorder from WBAI New York. I think that's the call letters. And it's also, you know, Law and Disorder is also carried by KKFI-FM here in Kansas City. And it comes on, I think, Tuesdays. I get it late. Nobody complains. I mean, if you missed it on Tuesday at KKFI, come over to Radio Free Kansas. Now, Law and Disorder, the latest.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear excerpts from a presentation examining a lawsuit filed against the CIA for allegedly violating privacy rights of journalists and lawyers visiting Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The presentation, sponsored by the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee, will also look at how the lawsuit might affect the U.S. attempt to extradite Julian Assange.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
In August 2022, a group of U.S. citizen attorneys and journalists sued the CIA and its former director, Mike Pompeo. They allege that the CIA, during Pompeo's tenure, spied on them during meetings with Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The WikiLeaks founder and whistleblower sheltered there for 7 years in an effort to avoid extradition to the United States to face criminal charges. The lawsuit says that the CIA violated the privacy rights of those journalists and lawyers. Plaintiffs include journalists Charles Glass and John Getz, and New York City attorneys Margaret Kunstler and Deborah Herbeck, who have represented Assange. The suit seeks compensatory and punitive damages for the plaintiffs for the violations of their rights. It also seeks the removal of any information held by the CIA, which was collected from them during their visits to Assange, and prevention of the release of any of this information to a third party. The CIA, as listeners may know, is prohibited from collecting intelligence on U.S. citizens, although several lawmakers have alleged that the agency maintains a secret repository of Americans' communications data. Richard Roth, the lead attorney in this case, had this to say. The United States Constitution shields American citizens from U.S. government overreach, even when the activities take place in a foreign embassy and in a foreign country. Journalists and lawyers visiting Assange were required to surrender their electronic devices to Undercover Global before each visit. UC Global is a private security company which was providing security to the embassy at that time. The lawsuit alleged that the company copied their information and handed it over to the CIA. In early November, Deborah Herbeck and our own Marjorie Cohn discussed the lawsuit and the case against Assange in a program sponsored by the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee. For our show today, we're delighted to bring you their remarks and their answers to several audience questions. Deborah Herbeck starts off the event. In addition to being a member of the Assange defense team, her law practice focuses on entertainment and small business law. And Marjorie is a member of the National Advisory Board of Assange Defense. Let's take a listen.
Thank you, Anne, for inviting me to address the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee about this important matter. Together with my colleague, Margaret Kunstler, and two national security journalists, just this past August, we started a lawsuit against the CIA and Mike Pompeo and the Spanish security company UC Global and its former CEO David Morales. And this is around the fact that when we visited Julian Assange in the embassy in Ecuador, we were spied on. Now, you may say, well, the CIA's job is to spy, and maybe that's not so terrible, but that's not the case at all. We're United States citizens, and we have the right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizure by the government. We were visiting our clients, our doctors were visiting their, Julian Assange was a patient, journalists were visiting their sources, and we were in an environment where we had an expectation of privacy from U.S. government intrusion. At the time of our visits, Julian was an asylee, essentially. He had been granted sanctuary in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because he feared that he would be extradited to the United States to face the sorts of charges he's actually facing now. And he was given protection by the Ecuadorian government. So when visiting him, we had assumed, it turns out quite naively, that we were on safe territory. We did, for we thought the safekeeping and the protection of Julian, turn over our electronic devices and our passports when we entered the embassy, and they were held in the custody of the security guards while we met with Julian. We had no idea that while we were meeting with Julian, in the very next room, the security guards were downloading information from our laptops, looking at, noting down numbers from our cell phones, making copies of our passports, not just the page with our faces and the information on it for record keeping, but where we traveled, who we'd seen, and then putting it all back together again so that when we went and picked it up and left, we had no idea that these materials had been tampered with. In some cases, like mine, it may not have made a terrible amount of difference. I feel violated, but I'm a media lawyer. I was visiting Julian to talk about things like whether a film company should be allowed to use his image in a documentary, etc. I don't have a lot of clients who whose information would have been on my computer that might have been compromised, but one of my colleagues, Nancy Hollander, she was representing Chelsea Manning at the time she visited Julian. She was representing prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, and still is, actively. And so the very government that was prosecuting her clients was accessing the materials on her electronic devices. And we remember this as we thought that these people were Ecuadorian government employees. We had no idea that, in fact, as it later transpired, it was a Spanish security firm called UC Global, who had been privately contracted to provide security at the Ecuadorian embassy. And initially that was by a friendly government. And what happened was in 2017, David Morales, who was the CEO of the private security company UC Global, attended a conference for private security companies in Las Vegas that was hosted at the Venetian Sands, which was owned by the late Sheldon Adelstein. And he was boasting about the fact that he had this good gig and that he had this sort of notorious person under his watch. And the personnel around Sheldon Adelstein, notified him of that fact. And before you know it, Adelson, who was, of course, quite close with the Trump administration, had arranged for Morales to essentially be flipped and turned into a CIA agent. And from that day forward, increasingly, every conversation, every document that was going in and out of the embassy, whether it was attorney-client privilege, whether it was a psychiatrist report, no matter what it was, every information that was on, as I said, our private cell phones, et cetera, was captured and transmitted to the CIA. And we know this. This isn't a crazy conspiracy theory. We know this because soon after Julian was taken out of the embassy in April of 2019, a couple of the security guards from UC Global became whistleblowers, essentially, to tell people what had been going on. They hadn't realized that the material that they were collecting was being delivered into the hands of the CIA in order to beef up a charge against Julian Assange, or I should say 18 charges. I think Marjorie's going to go into that a little bit more. They thought they were protecting him. And so when they realized that, in fact, Julian was right, and this whole thing had, in fact, been about capturing him and then delivering him to the United States, they weren't happy about it, and they blew the whistle, and they disclosed the fact that David Morales, their boss, had been bragging to them about the fact that he was now working for the Americans, that the company was going to be quite rich, that he was a mercenary, that he suddenly went from taking maybe two or three trips in his entire life from Spain to the United States to taking 64 trips to the United States in the course of the 2 years following that conference in Las Vegas, sometimes to New York, sometimes to Washington, D.C. and Virginia, which happens to be where the CIA is, and frequently to Nevada as well, where his CIA handlers were primarily located. This has been disclosed in affidavit testimony in the courts of Spain. There's a criminal investigation currently going on into UC Global and David Morales, and it's in the course of discovery in that case that Julian's Spanish lawyers, Balthazar Garzón and Aitor Martínez, have secured discovery that has alarmed the Spanish court to such an extent that they have issued a formal request to the U.S. government for Michael Pompeo and William Avenina, who was a CIA person at the time, and a number of other potential CIA witnesses to give testimony in the Spanish case to clarify and explain the evidence that has been presented that is before the court in Spain, showing essentially there's technical evidence that some of the that the IP addresses in Virginia, that there are IP addresses in Virginia where some of this material was live streamed to. There's a wealth of evidence to indicate that UC Global was ramping up its surveillance activities and in direct communication with people in the United States who are very close with the Trump government, and in particular with Mike Pompeo. And this coincided with a speech by Michael Pompeo, one of his very first speech as the head of the CIA in April of 2017. He took the opportunity not just to, and in fact barely, to talk about what he was going to do as the new head of the CIA, and devoted most of his speech to a tirade against WikiLeaks. And in the course of that speech, he designated WikiLeaks a non-state hostile agency. And what that essentially did was put the organization in a category that enabled the CIA to ramp up some of its more nefarious activities without congressional oversight. The CIA is a spying agency. It is supposed to be protecting the U.S. National interests, and it does do things that, which however much we might find them offensive, are technically legal when they're dealing with Al-Qaeda and investigating situations that are of true danger to the United States. In this situation, we have an organization we believe very strongly that they should be treated like any other publication. But regardless, Julian Assange was the head, the editor-in-chief at the time of a platform, an online publication that essentially existed for the purpose of whistleblowers being able to have a safe place to tell the world what things that were being done by governments all around the world against their own people, primarily war crimes, but all sorts of violations of human rights were disclosed through the WikiLeaks platform. And then WikiLeaks would take steps to ensure that the sources were verified. They would make sure that the materials disclosed were accurate and verified, that the materials were newsworthy, just like any journalist would do. So whether you call WikiLeaks a publication, whether you call Julian a journalist, it really doesn't matter. The activities that were going on were essentially investigative journalism, and the publishing of the dissemination of the information was essentially the dissemination of embarrassing items for the United States and UK and other governments around the world. And that is, of course, what the press exists to do. It's to hold governments accountable. It's the very First Amendment, press freedom. And the point of that is that without the protection for people who are brave enough to and just hardworking enough to dig a bit deeper and find out what's going on in our name using our tax dollars, we wouldn't know enough about governments to be able to, when we have democratic elections, vote with the information we need to do that. So my time's running up and I'm running out, but I would invite any questions you may have about the case, which is primarily to bring attention to the fact that the U.S. in Julian Assange's case has gone above and beyond what anyone would expect in terms of its efforts and its willingness to breach the law to get him, as revenge for the disclosure of war crimes, as revenge for the disclosure of what's called Vault 7, which was a very embarrassing leak of CIA materials. And I would invite you in particular to revisit an article that didn't get enough of attention by Zach Dorfman and Michael Isikoff in Yahoo News in September of 2021 that went into very well researched, talked to 30 national security and government personnel, the kidnapping and assassination and the London shootout inside the secret war plans against WikiLeaks. This article did not get enough attention, and one of the things we're really hoping to do with our case is shine a light on what's been going on in your name. Thank you, Ed.
That was New York attorney Deborah Herbeck, who is also a plaintiff in this case. We now turn to our own Marjorie Cohn, who unpacks the indictment against Julian Assange and the request for his extradition to the United States.
The indictment against Julian stems from WikiLeaks' 2010 to 2011 revelations of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and so-called Cablegate. The Iraq war logs included 400,000 field reports about the Iraq war, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, and the systematic torture, rape, and murder after U.S. forces handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. They included the Afghan war diary, 90,000 reports revealing more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had reported. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Called the Afghan war logs the most comprehensive history of war ever to be published during the course of the war. But perhaps the most notable release by WikiLeaks was the 2007 collateral murder video, in which a U.S. Army Apache attack helicopter gunship in Baghdad targets and fires on unarmed civilians. At least 18 civilians were killed, including two Reuters reporters and a man trying to rescue the wounded, and two children were injured. Then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, severing it in half. And that short four-minute video clip, which you can find on YouTube, it's called Collateral Murder Video, reveals evidence of three separate war crimes under the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual. Cablegate was a collection of confidential cables that were sent to the U.S. State Department from foreign embassies and consulates. And the New York Times, The Guardian, Le Monde, Der Spiegel, and El País all agreed to publish simultaneously these cables after redacting or editing out the identity of the agents. Now, Barack Obama prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior presidents combined. But even the Obama administration decided not to indict Julian Assange. They convened a secret grand jury and decided that they had what became known as the New York Times problem, because WikiLeaks did the same thing that the New York Times, Washington Post, The Guardian, etc. did. And if they indicted Julian Assange, they would also have to indict those news organizations as well. It was WikiLeaks' publication of the CIA hacking tools known as Vault 7, which Deborah mentioned, which the agency called the largest data loss in CIA history, that incurred the wrath of Trump's CIA director, Mike Pompeo. Vault 7 materials revealed electronic surveillance and cyber warfare by the CIA. It included the CIA's methods for breaking into smartphones, computers, TVs that were hooked up to the internet, Skype, stealing passwords, and circumventing encryption on Signal and WhatsApp, etc. And in 2017, after Pompeo called the WikiLeaks a non-state hostile intelligence service, as Deborah mentioned, CIA and government officials hatched secret war plans to abduct and kill Julian, according to the stunning Yahoo News report that Deborah also mentioned. Some senior CIA and Trump administration officials requested sketches or options for ways to assassinate Julian. Donald Trump himself, and you did not see this in the corporate media, which was is really an outrage, Trump himself asked whether the CIA could assassinate Julian and provide him options for doing so. Now, concerned that the CIA might kidnap or kill Julian, which could jeopardize a potential criminal prosecution, Trump's Department of Justice filed a secret indictment against Julian in 2018. It included, and they filed it in the Eastern District of Virginia, the U.S. District Court, which is the most right-wing court in the country, where the war on terror cases, so-called war on terror cases, have been filed. Those people lucky enough to even be charged in a court and not rot away at Guantanamo, which is another incredible, just, it's an outrage. But this secret indictment charged Julian with one count of violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for receiving the documents, classified documents, from Chelsea Manning, who was the whistleblower. And this one charge carried 5 years in prison. That was in March of 2018. In May of 2019, the Trump administration's Department of Justice filed a superseding indictment with 17 counts under the Espionage Act, which carry 170 years in prison. So that's a total of 175 years in prison. And then in June of 2020, apparently realizing that unless they could paint Julian Assange as a hacker instead of a journalist, they might have First Amendment problems with all of their Espionage Act counts, because he has done everything that other publishers and journalists do protected by the First Amendment. They filed a second superseding indictment to beef up the hacking charge from the first indictment. And in order to bolster this charge, the FBI collaborated with informant Siggy Thorderson to paint Assange as a hacker instead of a journalist. Thorderson later admitted to the Icelandic newspaper Stundin that he lied about Julian being a hacker in return for immunity from prosecution by the FBI because he was charged with many, many felonies, including sexual assault, etc. After a three-week extradition hearing, in January of 2021, UK Magistrate Judge Vanessa Baratzer ruled that WikiLeaks should not, that Julian Assange should not be extradited to the United States because given his fragile mental health from the years of confinement and UN Special Rapporteur Niels Meltzer concluded after meeting several times with Julian that he was suffering from prolonged psychological torture. The UK judge, Vanessa Baratzer, denied extradition. And keep in mind that Biden is continuing Trump's appeal of the denial of extradition. Instead of going along with his buddy Barack, which he likes to remind us that he does, if he did go along with his buddy Barack, he would have dismissed the request for extradition and dismissed this appeal. But Vanessa Baratzer ruled that Julian Assange would likely commit suicide if he were extradited to the United States for trial on this indictment and if he were held in the very, very heinous, harsh conditions of confinement in the United States. But later, after the extradition hearing, the United States was allowed to come forward with so-called assurances that if Julian Assange were extradited to the United States, he would not be held in the maximum security prison in Florence, Colorado. He would not be subjected to special administrative measures, which is basically holding him in isolation. And if he were convicted and sentenced, he could serve his sentence in Australia, not checking, of course, with the Australian government. But they were conditioned on Julian Assange not committing some acts which remained unnamed that would allow them to hold him in these conditions. Nevertheless, they would still hold him in equally onerous conditions in other supermax prisons with other very heinous conditions. So after hearing these so-called assurances, and I should say that the former UN Special Rapporteur, Agnès Callamard, rapporteur on extrajudicial summary and arbitrary execution, was skeptical of these so-called assurances. She said they cannot be taken at face value because of previous history. And she was referring to prior U.S. assurances that the U.S. reneged on. But the High Court in the U.K. accepted those assurances and reversed Baratzer's denial of extradition. And that was in December of 2021. In March of 2022, the UK Supreme Court denied Julian's appeal of the High Court decision. And in June of 2022, the Home Secretary in the UK approved the extradition of Julian Assange to the United States. On August the 26th, Julian filed his perfected grounds of appeal, asking the High Court to rule on issues that Baratzer had found against him on. This is not the suicide issue, but other issues. And they included that Julian is being prosecuted and punished for his political opinions in violation of the Extradition Act, that Julian is being prosecuted for protected speech in violation of the Extradition Act, that the extradition request itself violates the US-UK extradition treaty and international law because it is for a political offense, that the US government has represented the core facts of the case to the British courts, and that the extradition request and its surrounding circumstances constitute an abuse of process. This prosecution of Julian Assange is the first time that a journalist has been indicted under the Espionage Act for publishing truthful information. The United States has never prosecuted a journalist or news outlet for publishing classified information. And if Julian is ultimately extradited, tried, convicted, and imprisoned, it will send an ominous message to investigative journalists who would publish evidence of government wrongdoing. The point of this prosecution of Julian is to criminalize national security journalism. It actually involves the heart of what journalists do every day, which is to protect their sources, their confidential sources, and communicate with them in confidence, to cultivate these sources, to publish classified secrets. These are the pillars of national security investigative journalism, and this is what is at stake in this prosecution of Julian Assange. It will chill journalists from reporting classified information, which we need to know what the government is doing in our name, because they know that if they do that, they may suffer the same fate as Julian. And this, of course, is all in addition to the life of Julian Assange, who has been held, who has been basically confined for 10 years now with no charges that have been, well, the charges that have been filed against him, but he has been convicted of nothing. He has a wife and Stella Assange, two small children, and WikiLeaks has done all of us a great service. And so I am proud to say that I work on the National Advisory Board of Assange Defense and work with Anne and Deborah and many others to free Julian. There was recently a human chain of hundreds and hundreds of people surrounding Parliament in the UK calling for the release of Julian Assange. And I urge everyone to go to AssangeDefense.org and get involved in any way you can to free Julian Assange and persuade Joe Biden, Joe Biden's Department of Justice, to drop the extradition request and dismiss the indictment against Julian Assange. Thank you.
That was Marjorie Cohn, who is also a member of the National Advisory Board of Assange Defense. Marjorie and Deborah now answer a few questions from audience members. The first question is whether the attorneys have considered holding a mock trial in public to raise awareness of the issues involved in this case.
I think that's a great idea. Honestly, anything creative we can do to bring these issues to the attention of the U.S. public is really important. There has been increasing support of Julian in the case in general in the UK and in Europe. But in the United States, we're really far behind. And honestly, this is the center of where the action is right now. Julian would be out tomorrow if the Department of Justice just dropped the charges, just stopped asking for extradition. There is no case in the UK holding him. He's sitting in Belmarsh for almost 4 years, maximum security prison, awaiting extradition on an absurd indictment that the Trump administration brought. At the same time as there was this chain of 7,000 people around the UK Parliament, we also had a chain of people around the Department of Justice in DC, which was wonderful. It wasn't 7,000 people, but it was a significant turnout, and which is just wonderful. Randy Credico has been going around DC with this wonderful screen to just alert people about Julian Assange situation. Roger Waters is an amazing supporter and has been incredible at his concerts. He's been on tour the last several months. He's been raising awareness of the plight of Julian Assange and what this really means for press freedom in this country. The activism has to start here, has to come from the United States, because no government likes WikiLeaks, no government likes Julian Assange. The Obama government, which is basically Biden, would have gone after him if they could have. They decided they couldn't, which is great, but they're actually going after him now. They're going after him by continuing, the DOJ is continuing to pursue extradition on these charges, which are essentially, as Marjorie said, going to impact every single journalist in the United States and, by extension, us.
The next question concerns what has changed in the United States to allow Daniel Ellsberg to leak government documents decades ago, but not Julian Assange. The questioner also asked about Joe Biden's continued candidacy for president.
Daniel Ellsberg was prosecuted. He was prosecuted under the Espionage Act, and the reason that the charges were dismissed and he didn't spend the rest of his life in prison was because of government misconduct. And so they had to ultimately dismiss the case against him. But he was very much prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And this Espionage Act does not go after espionage. It has been not been used to go after espionage. It's really been used to go after opponents of the government. It was passed in 1917 and used by the Woodrow Wilson administration to go after people who opposed World War I. It was used against Eugene Debs. It was used against socialists and communists. It was used against the black press. And now, more recently, it's been used against whistleblowers and now for the first time against a journalist. In terms of your point about why are the criminals not in jail and Julian is, the very reason that Julian Assange was prosecuted and the substance of all of these indictments is his revelation and WikiLeaks revelation of war crimes by the United States. And it is the war criminals who don't want this information to see the light. And I agree with you 100% that Joe Biden should not be running for president again for many, many reasons. I think it is a loser. I think it would hand the election to probably Rick DeSantis because I think that Trump has been tarnished by the midterm elections. But that's another discussion altogether.
Another question dealt with critics and media claims that Julian Assange has blood on his hands. One charge is that he was careless and failed to redact sensitive names and information from released documents.
There has been a campaign of character assassination against Julian Assange dating back to pretty much when the revelations that are the subject of his imprisonment and the indictment came about, not coincidentally, pretty much as soon as, 2010 was when the Chelsea Manning revelations started to come out. And it was shortly thereafter that there were allegations that were later proven to be, that were investigated and dismissed by the Swedish government that were incredibly harmful to Julian's reputation. Basically, what we do in this country, or perhaps the world over, is we create pariahs out of our heroes. And it's so much easier to impact rights that affect everyone once you demonize somebody who's being charged with a particular offense. So in terms of the specific issue about the redaction, I can tell you that it was actually WikiLeaks who slowed down the release of the materials because of the extensive efforts that made to redact the names of sources and informants with the U.S. government who were local people on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq who might have been in danger had their names been disclosed. And it was actually the traditional press, the mainstream media, The Guardian, in particular, who ended up revealing the information that ended up in disclosing these people's identities. WikiLeaks actually taught the other media outlets how to redact. This was such a distortion of the truth, and yet people believe it because that's what they read in the papers, and because the papers are lying.
At this point in the event, the moderator asked Marjorie and Deborah to talk about Daniel Ellsberg's testimony at the Assange extradition hearing. Here are their responses.
Yes, Daniel Ellsberg, who, as was said, is one of the three co-chairs of Assange defense, along with Noam Chomsky and Alice Walker, testified very poignantly at Julian's extradition hearing about how important and critical WikiLeaks revelations of these war crimes was, and he drew parallels between the revelations of these war crimes and what he and Tony Russo did in the 70s, which was to publicize the Pentagon Papers, which revealed what was really happening with the Vietnam War. And of course, that revelation, together with the valiant struggle of the North Vietnamese, the National Liberation Front, led to the defeat of the United States, who left with its tail between its legs and ended the Vietnam War.
Daniel Ellsberg, and he's a huge hero. He was actually the whistleblower. Chelsea Manning, who's now out, was the whistleblower here. They're both extremely brave, and I'm very grateful for their actions. But they actually did have some level of obligation that they have a defense because they're whistleblowers, but that was breached by the revelations. Julian is in the hands of somebody who received this information and then just let us know about it. This is truly a situation where this is shooting the messenger in every step of the way. He had no duty to protect anyone. He had no duty to the United States government. He's not a U.S. citizen. He's not even a U.S. journalist. What would happen if the Chinese government decided to say that an American journalist who disclosed some humanitarian breaches by the Chinese government should be extradited to China to face charges for embarrassing the Chinese government? Or it's just absurd when you think about what we're doing, the policing of the world in this way, to criminalize anyone, wherever they are in the world, who says something that the U.S. government doesn't like.
An audience member asked Marjorie and Deborah to address the failure of the courts to prosecute war crimes and to hold the government accountable.
There was a complaint filed in federal district court in Northern California on behalf of an Iraqi woman claiming that Inder Comer was her lawyer, claiming that the invasion of Iraq and the commission of war crimes violated international law. It was a war of aggression in violation of the UN Charter. He was absolutely right on the law. It was ultimately thrown out. I don't think that there is a federal court in the United States that would agree to a prosecution for war crimes committed by every U.S. president that I can think of going way back, and certainly the most recent ones. But there is the International Criminal Court, which the United States has not ignored but refused to join, although 100 U.S. senators have, could they agree on anything? Well, they did agree that Russian officials should be prosecuted by the International Criminal Court for what they're doing in Ukraine, which is amazing because the United States doesn't think that the International Criminal Court should be used to prosecute Americans for their war crimes in Iraq or Afghanistan, or Israeli leaders for their illegal activities and occupation of the Palestinians. So there is pending in the International Criminal Court charges against leaders. It's a criminal court, so they charge individuals, leaders during the Afghan war, and it used to include U.S. leaders as well as Afghan leaders, but with a change in the court and the prosecutor, they've backed down on the charges against U.S. leaders. Charges against Israeli leaders are still pending. The U.S. is trying to undermine that. But I don't think that we're going to see any meaningful prosecutions of U.S. war criminals anytime soon.
I'd just like to second that, and let's get that. Unfortunately, is a bit of a pipe dream that the courts in the United States would hold government, anyone responsible for our war crimes, because the laws just aren't set up that way. But what we do have is a First Amendment, and the way that we hold war criminals accountable is by the press investigating and telling the voters what the government's doing in its name. And that is the closest we can get to accountability for war criminals in the United States, and that is why this case is so critical.
Another audience member asked Marjorie and Deborah what they thought the government's legal defense to free speech claims raised by the Assange defense team might be. He also asked if Julian had access to a computer during his detention.
There is a limitation on free speech, and it's the famous case where it said you don't have the right to scream fire in a crowded theater. And so the government, the U.S. government's defense, I guess you would say, to charges of violation of freedom of speech is we have to protect national security. And as Noam Chomsky eloquently said in one of our Free Assange panels, national security means what the government doesn't want you to know they're doing in our name. It's kind of a catch-all for, well, we can't tell you, but it's going to impact national security, so you can't you can't freely talk about it or publish it. It is true that Julian Assange is a national of Australia, and here he is being prosecuted, or the Biden administration is seeking to prosecute him in the U.S. as a foreign national under U.S. law. That's something that invariably would be litigated if he was being extradited to the United States. And in terms of whether Julian has access to a computer, I don't know. I think he does, but maybe Deborah can speak to that.
I don't believe he does. He's in maximum security prison. He does finally, after his lawyers in Britain, Gareth Pearce and her team, have done a tremendous amount of work to improve his conditions in prison. But it's still a maximum security prison. So he is allowed to speak to his lawyers on a fairly regular basis. By a telephone, basically, and get information about, you know, what's going on. But he, to my knowledge, does not have access to any computer.
On the question about Julian having blood on his hands, the moderator noted that at trial, no prosecutor could name anyone who had been injured or killed by WikiLeaks disclosures. Deborah Herbeck responded, thus.
We know that had there been any adverse consequences of these leaks, we'd all be hearing about it, and we haven't been. And yes, in the testimony, it was to the extent that you can testify to a negative, there was testimony that there was no such results. But I just want to get to the fundamental point of, like, the fact that things are called WikiLeaks disclosures even just drives me mad. You know, I follow the news. I didn't hear about any of this from WikiLeaks. I heard about it from Rachel Maddow. I heard about it from the New York Times. I mean, the mainstream media amplified the disclosures, and that's why we all have the information we have. And yet Julian is the only person sitting in jail. WikiLeaks is the only organization being tarred with this brush. Now, if the problem is, the hypothetical problem is, that if national security secret information gets out there, people, informants might be in danger, why aren't the other outlets that are actually, nobody goes on to WikiLeaks, nobody, I mean, except for researchers who and academics who are researching human rights around the world, who find the WikiLeaks platform incredibly, the WikiLeaks archive incredibly useful. Regular people getting their news do not get it directly from WikiLeaks. We only, and people that might want to use the disclosures against the U.S. government interests are not getting it from WikiLeaks. They're getting it from mainstream media outlets. And if it's a crime to disseminate this information, then it's a crime that everyone should be in jail for. And I think we can all agree that that would be a terrible, terrible thing. So I just want to make that point.
Another question was about instances in which the law has been weaponized against Julian Assange and not applied with an intent for justice. Here's what Marjorie had to say, with comments from Deborah following.
This Espionage Act has been selectively enforced. It's called selective enforcement. Government officials leak national defense information to the press all the time. But only when critics of the government like Julian Assange do it are they prosecuted. General Petraeus is a perfect example, where he was telling his girlfriend national defense secrets. I also want to add that there was a recent, I guess, release of a report which found that the United States ranks 26th in rankings of democracies in the United States. And Attorney General Merrick Garland just announced last month, the end of last month, a new policy, a new revised Department of Justice news media policy, where he wrote, "These regulations recognize the crucial role that a free and independent press plays in our democracy, because freedom of the press requires that members of the news media have the freedom to investigate and report the news. The new regulations are intended to provide enhanced protection to members of the news media from certain law enforcement tools and actions that might unreasonably impair news gathering." Well, that is the height of hypocrisy, given the prosecution of Julian Assange, which Merrick Garland is pursuing full speed ahead. And I just want to mention one more thing, and that is that during the Donald Trump administration, where there were leaks from the Supreme Court, and I think we're talking probably about the Dobbs opinion, which ultimately overturned Roe v. Wade, Trump said, "You tell the reporter who it is, and if the reporter doesn't want to tell you, bye-bye. The reporter goes to jail. When the reporter learns he's going to be married to a certain prisoner who's extremely strong and tough, I mean," he will say, "you know, I think I'm going to give you the information." And he said the reporter would give up the identity of the leaker as soon as they realize they're going to be the bride of another prisoner very shortly. He was threatening that journalist be raped by other prisoners. That was then President Donald Trump.
I 100% support everything that Marjorie just said. And governments just don't play by the rules around the world, but even in the U.S. We have to stop being naive enough to think that the justice system is blind, that if it's in the United States government's interest, they will abuse the process time and time again. And this is absolutely demonstrated in this case. As recently as today, there's a report about how the United States government meddled in the Ecuadorian elections to try to, of all things, support the right-wing opposition party against Correa, who was the president who offered asylum to Julian, and basically said, "Well, you know, we'll help you get in as long as you promise to hand us over Julian when we're successful." And that's ultimately, it's a little bit more complicated how it all went down, but that's ultimately what happened. They managed to smear the government that had given Julian Assange sanctuary. Then that led to someone else being elected. And ultimately, in order to curry favor with the US government, the Ecuadorian government opened the door and let the UK take him and hand him over to the United States. So there's no process that the government is respecting, sadly. We're very far from that.
At the conclusion of the proceeding, Marjorie Cohn emphasized the importance of getting involved in the campaign to free Julian Assange. She also underscored the larger issues implicated in his case. Here's what she had to say.
I've said this, but I want to reiterate how important it is to get involved in this campaign to free Julian Assange. As Deborah has mentioned, the corporate media has done its best to tar Julian Assange, and even a lot of Democrats, people, so-called liberals, just dismiss him because of the trumped-up charges. They weren't even charges. There was an investigation, sexual assault investigation in Sweden, where the two women later recanted, and so that plus the publication of some DNC emails that revealed bad acts and by the Hillary Clinton administration have led people, some people on the left, to throw out the baby with the bathwater and fail to realize that what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are being, what Julian Assange is being indicted for, is revealing U.S. war crimes and torture. And that is really, really important to keep in mind. And so anything people can do to support this campaign to free Julian, again, AssangeDefense.org is the website. I strongly encourage you to get involved.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Coming up, the Tax Cast from the Tax Justice Network. Now, if you haven't discovered or looked, just do a search. I don't care. Use Yadda Dadda Duck or whatever, Google. or use whatever search engine you use, Tax Justice Network, you'll find a worldwide network of people who are hunting down the billionaires and making them pay taxes, the ones that hide their money, the millionaires and billionaires who hide their money in order to not pay taxes. They've developed at the Tax Justice Network what they call, I believe it's called exactly, a financial security index. And what it is it tracks down where people, wealthy people, hide their money in order to avoid taxes. And they've had some tremendous successes. In several countries, they've passed laws in Europe and in the Caribbean. I don't know how to say it. In the Caribbean area, they have successfully got to pass laws and establish a registry of the wealthy and how they pay taxes. And unfortunately, Delaware, the state, is one of the biggest tax havens. So I'm going to play the Tax Cast. It comes out monthly by Naomi Fowler, and she does a great job. And her and I both have we share a weakness for Roaring Twenties music, the old music. So enjoy this, and I'll see you tomorrow, or you'll hear from me tomorrow on Free Thought Friday.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. Join us there. And if you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on our subscribers list. Coming up later, we discuss sovereignty, the boomerang effect, and our dominant global economic system.
The kind of loss of feeling of control in the United Kingdom, that loss of feeling of sovereignty, that loss of feeling of democratic accountability is connected to the erosion of sovereignty and erosion of democratic accountability that was allowed to happen to the former colonies of particularly the British Empire, but all empires. What happens in the colonies doesn't simply stay there, but it comes back on the homeland and it starts to impact how its economy, its society, and its politics operate. And I think that's a lot of what we see in Britain right up until today.
I talked to Kojo Karam about his fantastic book, Uncommon Wealth, Britain and the Aftermath of Empire. Read that and you'll never think the same way about economics again. Before that, this month, we saw several huge failures. I'm going to tell you about two of them. One of them is the collapse of the crypto exchange company in the Bahamas. Various investigations are beginning into possible fraud. Crypto has always been of interest to us because various tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions have been setting up exchanges in an expansion to their financial offerings that are already woefully underregulated. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? Well, just about everything. So now there's an $8 billion black hole. At least 1 million users are owed money, but with crypto, they don't get the same protections as other investors. Crypto player Sam Bankman-Fried spent a lot of money lobbying politicians, about $41 million in the 2022 midterm elections, apparently, mostly to Democrats. His net worth has now gone from $32 billion to zero overnight. And it's important to say, this latest collapse can't be pinned just on one person. He's surrounded by huge numbers of enablers, including venture capitalists. Another big crypto player and former business partner of his is Changpeng Zhao, known as CZ Binance or CZ Binance. He's operating in the UAE, one of the jurisdictions flagged by the Tax Justice Network as a huge and rising secrecy offender, also causing particular harms to African countries through diverting corporate taxes. It's a pattern of rises of autocratic regimes, by the way. Just listen to the disgust of economist and crypto critic Nouriel Roubini here speaking about this at a conference in the UAE.
Unfortunately, this is an ecosystem that is totally corrupt. And I think the lesson of the last few weeks is these people should be out of here. I can't believe that CZ and Binance has a license to operate in the UAE. He's under investigation by the US Justice Department for money laundering, and he has residence in this country. The regulator should be thinking carefully. That's a walking time bomb. He's a walking time bomb. He should be kicked out of this country. He should not be allowed to operate.
Nouriel Roubini. Sam Bankman-Fried's now collapsed crypto exchange company turns out to be incorporated heavily in the secrecy jurisdictions of Delaware and Antigua. The complexity is mind-boggling. I will cover crypto at some point on the TaxCast. Moving on to the second huge failing this month, we at the Tax Justice Network have written an open letter about it to the G20, who just met in Bali. According to our estimates, last year, nations were losing over $300 billion a year in corporate tax revenue, and it was impossible to update this figure for you this year. That's because, and we're alerting the G20 about this in our letter, the OECD failed to publish the data on time, as it's committed to G20 nations to do. They only published the data after the G20 summit, so no way for us or for world leaders to assess progress made. So much for accountability. It's already bad enough that that data is very restrictive. It's restrictive because it allows multinationals to report their activities country by country in private, not in public. Their tax behaviour is anonymised. That's very protective behaviour towards what are largely OECD country multinationals, isn't it? And now, this year, because they published even that data too late, it means we can't tell you how much we estimate your country individually is losing to corporate tax abuse through profit shifting. And we can't tell you what progress there has been or not since our last estimates. I'm talking to Alex Cobham of the Tax Justice Network. Alex, this is important for many reasons, because we've seen that with public country-by-country reporting made mandatory for European Union banks, as it is, they do pay more tax when this data is made public. So we know that alone can prevent one in every four tax dollars being lost to corporate abuse. That means just by insisting this corporate data is public, governments would recover, we reckon, almost $90 billion. Of losses. So Alex, the OECD is failing. What's the Tax Justice Network asking the G20 to do about it?
What we're asking the G20 to do is to reconsider the mandates that it's been giving the OECD, asking the OECD to lead on international tax. After 10 years, it's clear that the OECD has failed to deliver the kind of substantive reforms of the international tax rules that we all need. And so the latest estimate we have is $483 billion of lost revenues each year around the world, disproportionately suffered by lower income countries, but actually the biggest amounts being lost to OECD members themselves. This is neither inclusive in its processes nor effective in its outcomes. In addition, the OECD has dropped the ball on this global public good of country by country reporting. Instead of providing the data publicly so that we can hold companies and tax authorities and the OECD itself accountable, they're keeping the data largely private, and even the aggregate data, they're now almost 5 years behind in publishing, making it very difficult for anyone to track what's going on. So we've said to the G20, it's time to look to the United Nations, as the G77 group of developing countries has long called for, and instead see international tax rule setting there.
Yeah, and African countries have called for a United Nations tax convention. We're seeing some movement on that now, aren't we, even though it's being watered down.
So we've seen the Africa group bring forward this very good resolution calling for the start of negotiations on the UN tax convention. But we've also seen a really heavy pushback from the main OECD members. And so where we've got to now is a diluted version, a compromise that requests this year that the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, provide a report on the possibilities of a UN tax convention or similar instrument. Now, though, the OECD itself has mobilized very hard, writing to ambassadors, sending people to New York, trying to get even that compromise rejected. Whether they're successful, we'll find out next week. But either way, this is the beginning, not the end of a process. The OECD's failure to be effective or inclusive has really led to this consensus that we need to move ahead at the UN. They're fighting a rearguard action against that, but ultimately that's doomed to fail, and then we'll get to the possibility of something much better.
Thanks, Alex. I hope so. That's all very relevant to my next conversation. I'm really happy to have Dr. Kojo Karam of Birkbeck University of London with me today on the TaxCast. His latest book, Uncommon Wealth, Britain and the Aftermath of Empire, gets you thinking very differently about the inequality challenges we're living today across the world. No matter what your nationality or where you're listening to us, this is relevant to you. And no, it doesn't have to be this way. I've got about 50 questions which I can't possibly ask you, but I wish this book was on all school curriculums. I wish all politicians had to read it before they became politicians. And it's not just a book for British people, is it? Because I've travelled and lived in different countries myself, and I've heard so many times the ways that people have internalised the sources of their problems, and it all comes from this sort of mistaken, misguided narrative that we're all fed about how economies work, about development, how people misunderstand economies. You're looking at things from such a different way that some people are used to. In the same way that I suppose Tax Justice Network back in 2003, they started doing their campaigning using research that looked at corruption from the opposite end of the kaleidoscope. So it was definitely not what the big NGOs were doing, like Transparency International or something, not looking at the pretty low-level corruption stuff, but looking at the global financial architecture, right? The structures that have been put in place by what turns out to be very much former colonial powers, and, you know, one of the reasons that we're campaigning for the making of global tax rules to be happening within the United Nations and not within the OECD. But I suppose before I ask you some of my questions, I just wanted to clarify the words that we use, because they're just so important, aren't they? And I wanted to ask you about the description, the third world. You use it a lot in the book, and I know that the third world movement was once such a proud thing, a proud movement, and a lot of nations owned that title, although since then it's become a kind of a pejorative term, but you do use it. And, you know, if you look at what's in use, you know, the term plundered nations is also used, and obviously the most common mainstream is developing nations and so-called emerging economies. Just because ideas about development are so skewed, should we be using third world, as you do in the book?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's one that I've not been asked before in terms of commenting on the book. I think that a lot of the description of the third world project, as I draw upon the book, looking at, you know, the work of people like the Ghanaian president, Kwame Nkrumah, looking at the work of people like the Jamaican president, Michael Manley, and, you know, the non-aligned movement that surrounded their work, things like the New International Economic Order. These are groupings and movements that had real urgency and real momentum in the period between, say, the 1950s to the late 70s, early 80s. I draw upon the use of the third world label when talking about that moment, because they very much claimed that title as a positive, thinking about this idea of a third world, not in the way that we've come to understand it, you know, in terms of a hierarchy of worlds, you know, and the idea that a third world is the bottom, you know, it's kind of like the third division in English football. It's the bottom level, and it's something that's shameful, something that's associated with poverty, something that's associated with uncivilization. You know, this is the way that by the time you get to the 80s and certainly the 90s and early 2000s, the idea of a third world is very much a term of insult. But in that initial response to the decolonial moment, the idea of a third world is very much posited as a kind of alternate world, you know, a third option, this other way, this other imagining of how relations between nations and between peoples could actually be cultivated. And so when I talk about that era, I very much do kind of draw upon the third world, because that's what people like Michael Manley, you know, would proudly boast that they were presenting to these institutions like the United Nations. But I think by the time we get to the 2000s and the contemporary moment, I don't tend to use the label just because that movement has kind of lost its momentum. And so I think it's a very time-limited concept in terms of its positivity, but I think there's great lessons that we can learn from returning to that moment and thinking about, well, how else could the world have been different than the world that we're faced in now? You know, who was offering alternative ideas? Who was offering, like Manley, you know, led upon a new international economic order? The resolution that was passed at the UN by Manley as part of the third worldist moment, you know, talks about ideas like enshrining in law a permanent sovereignty over national resources for all nations of the world, enshrining in law a right to food, enshrining in law a right for nation states to hold transnational corporations that operate in their jurisdiction accountable. And so this is the moment of the third worldist era, and I think that that's something that we often tend to forget. And, you know, that world-changing potential, I don't think is carried in the contemporary labels that we use for countries in the global south, whether that is global south, whether that is developing nations, whether that is emerging nations. You know, all of these have a kind of teleology underneath them, an idea that countries in Africa, countries in Asia are simply becoming a version of Western European and North American countries. And so they're not offering us anything different. They're just on the path to becoming like us. And I think the third world moment between the 50s and the early 80s very much was saying, no, we're not trying to become like you. We're trying to change the rules and the coordinates of the global order.
Oh, and the ideals of enshrining rights in law is exactly what social justice activists are trying to achieve in Chile at the moment with the reform of their constitution. I want to ask you about the boomerang effect that goes throughout the book. And you demonstrate in the book how the breakdown of the British Empire blows back across the richer world, and I just love the way every chapter starts with a different scene from the breakdown of the British Empire, and it really directly connects that to the structures that still govern the world today. So the boomerang effect, that's a concept from the French writer and politician Aimé Césaire, and you demonstrate it in many different ways, looking at the history, going right up to the present day. So you look at borders, offshore tax havens, free ports, privatising services that should be public, outsourcing democracy that's supposed to protect people from capital, debt, the creation of the corporation, property law. But the overarching idea is that the UK is replicating internally what it has imposed externally. And when a nation imposes injustice on another nation, it always has a damaging internal effect that will come back to it. And one of your points that you make in the book, as I understand it, is if nothing else, just out of self-preservation, Britain really needs to understand its past because it's continuing to shape its present and its future.
Yeah, that's very much a real powerful encapsulation of what I was trying to argue in the book. But I think that recently there has been a kind of growth of interest in the histories of the British Empire, which have been really poorly taught and very much kind of suppressed in the public consciousness, despite the fact that this is very recent history. That particular decolonial moment, that particular breakdown of the British Empire in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, this is an ancient history. Often when we talk about the empire, people talk about 17th and 18th century plantation slavery, and everyone imagines it's like guys running around with red coats and muskets. That's the, you know, this is the 1970s. This is when a lot of your listeners will have been alive, or maybe if not them, their parents will have been alive, when these changes are happening. And the reason why I wanted to talk about, well, what are the consequences of these changes, particularly on an economic basis, was to push back on the way that we often talk about empire as simply a kind of cultural phenomenon. You know, we've begun to talk about it, and this is obviously a valuable conversation, but it's around statues, it's around street names, it's around the institution's education or culture. And I really wanted to talk about the primary driver of empire, not just the British Empire, but any empire, which is material. People travel across the world in order to extract resources and transfer them across borders and create a financial and legal architecture in order to legitimize that. And that has consequences. And so when we talk about today's economy, when we think about corporate tax avoidance, when we think about the weaponization of private debt, when we think about the dominance of multinational corporations vis-a-vis the interests of popular democracy, we can start to connect a lot of those back to the history of the British Empire and specifically to decisions that were made around the time of decolonization. And this, I think, is kind of counterfactual to a lot of people, because we are all taught that what happens in the global south is simply part of the developing project. It's part of this teleology, this movement towards them becoming like us. You know, I write a chapter in the book around the protection of the Anglo-Iranian oil company from the democratic demands of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran around the time of decolonization. And, you know, the British government supported the interests of the Anglo-Iranian oil company when Mossadegh tried to nationalize it and removed him from office and ensure that they could recover their oil refineries in the Abadan region. Now, this protection of the Anglo-Iranian oil company starts to sound very familiar when we realize that the Anglo-Iranian oil company, as soon after this kind of international scandal, changed its name to British Petroleum and then BP. And then we look at 2022 and we look at the cost of living crisis and we see again the British government protecting the interests of these massive oil companies who are recording record profits, BP perhaps more than any of them, whilst everyday people are struggling to be able to heat their homes and be able to sustain themselves and their families. And so this boomerang, this blowback of what happened in decolonization, I think helps us have a clearer picture of the global economy, that what happens in the colonies doesn't simply stay there, but it comes back on the homeland and it starts to impact how its economy, its society, and its politics operates. And I think that's a lot of what we see in Britain right up until today.
Yeah, absolutely. What's really interesting about, you mentioned Mossadegh in Iran and others who initially successfully led independence movements discovered that sovereignty didn't equal control, you know, and I think what's really fascinating is this weaponizing of the notion of sovereignty during the Brexit campaign. I mean, first of all, the irony of that when Britain violently took away the sovereignty of so many other nations for such a long time and then presided over a newly kind of sculpted empire through tax havens and abusive global tax rules that continues today. But also the fact that it's not really sovereignty in the way that it's being portrayed by the politicians who want to see basically the kind of deprivation and carte blanche for elites that's long been a reality in Africa, Asia and the Caribbean. You know, austerity's just been a normality for forever. And you refer to them as third world laboratories. But the desire that the Brexiteers were tapping into was real, you know, the take back control feeling and the helplessness people felt was real, but that's the feeling of loss of control against elites and corporations. But actually the Brexiteers were using that feeling to push the Singapore upon Thames model of, you know, completely liberated capital and so-called free markets to wreak their worst havoc in complete freedom, no matter what.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The inability for ordinary people to hold not just their political elites, but the people who set the rules of their economic conditions to account. This idea that no matter who you vote for, no matter which party you support, the conditions in your area will continue to get worse and worse, and your living standards, the value of your wages vis-a-vis the value of assets, will continue to decline year upon year. And that feeling of loss of control is, I think, the kind of nucleus that the Brexit campaign was able to tap into and then redirect it towards the European Union or immigrants or anybody apart from that global financial architecture that has continued to undercut living standards all across the world and even now here in the former heart of empire. And what I tried to do in the book is map out how the kind of loss of feeling of control in the United Kingdom, that loss of feeling of sovereignty, that loss of feeling of democratic accountability is connected to the erosion of sovereignty and erosion of democratic accountability that was allowed to happen to the former colonies of particularly the British Empire, but all empires in that aftermath of decolonization from the 1950s to the 1980s. Decolonization, we talk a lot about it now, like as a metaphor, you know, what does it mean? Decolonize curriculums, decolonize collections, decolonize everything. But in terms of what decolonization was from the 1950s to the 1970s, it was quite simply the greatest multiplication of democratic power that the world has ever seen. All of a sudden, two-thirds of the world transferred from being colonial subjects, where they didn't have that power of democracy, into being sovereign nation states. And so all of a sudden, you get sovereign governments everywhere from Nigeria to Jamaica to Ghana to India to Singapore. And for companies that operated across all those different territories, this obviously created a bit of a challenge, because now you have, rather than one jurisdiction which you operate under, the British Empire, you now have 5, 6, 7 different governments that can impose labor regulations, can impose tax demands, can impose protectionist policies. And so what happened to a lot of those countries was, through the weaponization of structural adjustment program, conditional loan agreements, the offshoring of wealth, there was the slow erosion of the power of sovereignty, the slow erosion of democratic potential within those territories. And by allowing that to happen and often supporting that, the government of the United Kingdom created the conditions for the undermining of sovereignty, even right here in the United Kingdom. And I think that when people want to talk about, we want to take back control, I think we need to think about it on an international level rather than a kind of narrow nationalist level.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting in the book. And the boomerang effect when it comes to tax and tax havenry has really very obviously blown back against the richer nations, who have been sort of the main offenders when it comes to sucking all this revenue out of different nations. They've also undermined their own tax base and their own governance. As you know, we've been producing studies on how much each nation is draining away in revenue from other nations. And what it always comes back to is that it's about the undermining of democracy, because tax havens and the lack of rules forcing multinationals to report publicly what they're doing in each jurisdiction, financial secrecy, weak regulation, it all means that lawmaking by elected governments can become irrelevant. And there's no zero either. You know, we've seen for decades how the state is increasingly subsidising corporations now. The race to the bottom never ends. And in some ways, we're even back to the sort of the commercial corporation model as it functions during empire, you know, the company state. I mean, it is as bad as that.
I definitely do agree with you. I think that the work of the Tax Justice Network, you know, show the connection between the kind of afterlife of the British Empire, the legacy of imperialism, and the current system of financialized tax evasion. Tax havens in the world position themselves as these new centers where finance capital could avoid the demands of democratic sovereignty. And they did this at the time of decolonization to position themselves as the bolt holes for international finance capital without having to face those democratic demands that other jurisdictions were now subject to. And this has had a drastic impact on the movement and flow of wealth all around the world, and has really assisted in the accelerating wealth inequality that we see not only in the global south, but now increasingly as well in the global north. You know, these legacies of empire is what we need to think about when we talk about decolonization in order to create a much more equitable world. And it's the part of the conversation that I think the government and, you know, the kind of mainstream politicians and newspapers in this country are very reluctant to have.
Yeah, and for me, the saddest part of the book is that chapter where you look at the once really hopeful period for the Third World Movement, and particularly Jamaica's role in leading that dream of a new international economic order. And they got so far, and it seems almost impossible now to look back on those times and see how far they actually did get in utilising the United Nations. And it was such an important forum for such a potentially radical change. You know, we had in 1974 the declaration of the establishment of a new international economic order. It all went terribly wrong and failed, but it was so hopeful at one point. And you call it the end of the Third World. It's just such a tragedy that it didn't make it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think of the failure of the International Economic Order and the defeat of the Manley government in Jamaica very much as the prologue to the emergence of neoliberalism, both in the UK and in the US. And we talk a lot about neoliberalism these days, particularly as I think we're now in a place in 2022 where a lot of people are seeing the promises of neoliberalism, this idea of deregulation and privatization and financialization, creating this tsunami of wealth that kind of lifts all boats. We're now really seeing the hollowness of that promise as we struggle through a cost of living crisis here in the United Kingdom, increasing wealth inequality, stagnating wages, escalating house prices and asset prices. People are seeing the promise of neoliberalism fail, and we're starting to think, well, where did it come from? How did we end up believing this? How did it become so triumphant? And I think to know that, you can't understand that neoliberalism without understanding what it came to defeat and what it came to replace, and that is that third worldist non-aligned challenge to the international economic order, that declaration that was passed at the United Nations of the international economic order, which read today seems, yeah, remarkably radical to have got through the United Nations, but got through at a moment where politicians like Manley recognized that as more and more countries became decolonized and therefore members of the United Nations, that in the General Assembly, in fact, it was the former colonized countries that had the majority, because unlike a lot of other international institutions, in the General Assembly of the United Nations, one nation, one vote. And so they thought, well, if we can start to work together and band people together, we can start to create rules around transnational trade that might benefit us and maybe benefit the world. You know, when we think about some of the sustainability claims that are in the International Economic Order, you know, we could all be in a very different place in terms of climate change had they been able to complete their objectives. But as a result, the emergence of neoliberalism and the kind of repurposing of the financial international institutions, particularly the IMF and the World Bank, where places like the United Kingdom, United States had a much greater influence than in the United Nations General Assembly, you know, starts to undercut the optimism of that new international economic order moment. And the imposition, like I mentioned, of structural adjustment programs and conditional loan agreements on these governments, and the use of sovereign debt in order to kind of defang these governments, is the beginnings of neoliberalism. And the death of the new international economic order, which actually happens, is at the only North-South conference that has ever occurred in Cancun in Mexico, which is really symbolic because this is the kind of the first major international conference that Margaret Thatcher attends and Ronald Reagan as well. And they both attend with the real dream of essentially killing the UN resolution in its crib and ensuring that things like the UN Development Bank that they wanted to establish never gets born. You know, the kind of overseeing commission for transnational corporate governance never gets born. And we really start to see that triumph of the rhetoric of, well, the best thing that these countries can do is not try and change the rules of the global economy, but, you know, pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, you know, liberalize and deregulate and welcome in finance capital. You know, that's what Thatcher comes back from Cancun and advocates in Parliament. And I think that was just a really useful rhetorical mask for the protection of the interests of finance capital against the sovereign demands of democratic people all across the world. And that has had real consequences for how our global economy functions, not just in the global south, but also right here in the United Kingdom.
Right, and actually, if the Third World Movement had succeeded in what it was doing through the United Nations, it actually would have really, as you say, really would have been to the great benefit of the whole world, not just the Third World nations, so-called. As you say, the whole thing really got shot down by Thatcher and Reagan, and a very, very damaging economic system has just completely taken hold ever since. And so I mentioned earlier about how we're pushing to move the right to make the global tax rules from the OECD, which is the Rich Countries Club, as we call it, but also largely former colonial nations and the worst offenders in terms of tax haven offenders. Can a third world movement ever hope to utilise the forum of the United Nations once again? Could we see that in our lifetime? I mean, you mentioned climate crisis. That surely pushes the momentum forward for parts of the world most affected to reunite, to fight for certain things together. I know that Nkrumah had such faith in the potential of the United Nations, you know, and he said, I look upon the United Nations as the only organisation that holds out any hope for the future of mankind. And I don't want to be naive about the United Nations and how existing power balances play out, no matter what the forum. Could we see the United Nations be used in a similar manner, at least with moving tax rule setting? Would you support that as a sort of a fairer and more inclusive rulemaking? Can it go further than that? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely think that it's preferable to have, like you mentioned, the tax rules located within the United Nations as an institutional home than the OECD. You know, this is where we can see all the different countries of the world represented and at least have a nominal notion of kind of sovereign equality. You know, that's enshrined in the very first articles of the UN Charter, that each nation in this forum is as equal in terms of, you know, juridically as the next one. And so at least in principle, it's definitely preferable. But I think the idea that the United Nations offers the potential and optimism and hope that it did in that mid-20th century to early late 20th century period, you know, where people considered the United Nations to be the great hope of all peoples across the world to facilitate a more inclusive and more egalitarian future. You know, I think that the last 40 years or so have really shown the limitations of the United Nations in terms of holding to account the powerful countries in the OECD, one of the powerful countries in terms of the UK, United States security objectives, everything from the war on drugs to the war on terror. The United Nations has been either, you know, very weak in terms of being able to confront them, or even sometimes a facilitator of that kind of transnational securitized violence. And so I think that it offers some potential, but I don't think it's going to be the locus of activists and transformational energy that it was in that initial period after its founding. You know, we need to remember the United Nations paralleled that arc of decolonization, and so it was born as the first countries were being decolonized. It's actually relatively slow, a little slower than even the League of Nations in terms of being like explicitly against the interests of colonialism, but eventually by the 1960s you get the UN Committee for Decolonization, and it starts to become a vehicle through which to encourage and facilitate greater decolonization of nations. But I think that now there's a little bit more cynicism about its potential and a feeling it can be a place of struggle, but it's not the place of struggle.
Right. In the book, you contrast the celebrations of 50 years of Ghanaian independence with the Brexit celebrations in the UK, and how neither promise has been fulfilled. And I just have to ask you this, because I try not to depress TaxCast listeners too much. And maybe for myself as well, I just feel like I have to find some hopeful ways forward in what is a very, very challenging environment where everything is so much in the grip of the economic system that we have established for ourselves and the rest of the world. You do talk about that it doesn't have to be this way. Where do you place your hopes for this future and for justice and restitution of the harms empires inflicted on nations and people?
I think that, you know, holding on to that optimism and recognizing that the increased awareness of the connections between the wealth inequality that we're struggling with all across the world and the United Kingdom, as much as almost anywhere else in the Western world, the connections between that wealth inequality and the history, the very recent and very bloody history of empire and decolonization, I think is starting to become more and more clear in people's minds. And that is creating pressure for some of the legal, financial, and economic loopholes and hangovers from empire to face public pressure of being either removed or at least held up to democratic accountability. An example that gave me some optimism very recently was in the debate around the next conservative leader. Very rare that those kind of debates would give me any hope, but what I was struck by was that this was, I think, the very first time I noticed that multiple candidates were asked about their tax status and their non-dom tax status and whether they had offshore overseas accounts. I saw a bunch of them being asked. There is a clear contradiction between benefiting from transnational tax loopholes, you know, that are hangovers of empire, that allow people to be able to hide their wealth from the demands of a sovereign government, and being the head of a sovereign government. That is a contradiction that people are increasingly not willing to tolerate. And so that gave me a bit of hopes of optimism that, yeah, it could be in the very near future that it's simply not acceptable to be a major politician and be a beneficiary of an offshore account. I think that's starting to change. And I think that that's going to create pressure maybe for those tax loopholes to not be there anymore. The work that Tax Justice Network are doing is creating more awareness, perhaps creating the conditions in which people say that this type of funneling out of wealth from countries is not acceptable. You know, when it was the 70s and the 80s, and it was countries in West Africa and the Caribbean complaining about this, saying, hang on a second, how are we supposed to build sustainable societies if all of our wealth is being siphoned off to offshore accounts? People dismissed them and thought that those were the complaints of, you know, backward nations of the world. Well, now we're starting to see that consequence and that impact right here in the former heart of empire, and I think that's something that people are increasingly not willing to tolerate.
You've been listening to Kojo Karam speaking about his book Uncommon Wealth, Britain and the Aftermath of Empire. It's published by John Murray Press. You can find more details in the show notes. That's it for this month. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.